G'day mate, how you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network, here where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him, Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know, all here on one Fortnite with Podcasts here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network. G'day, mate. How you going? Welcome to Lethal Mullet Podcast live here on Fandom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia. Joining us tonight here on the show is the Bearded Trio's owner, operator, and all-round amazing dude. That is, of course, Rob Wainfer, an old dear pal of mine who used to podcast with us many years ago, covering all things like Stargate and much, much more. So he's here to talk about his amazing fandoms from the 1980s. And in the meantime, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the one, the only, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and where I think he should be in the next few years. And also, you got to love one thing, and that is, of course, the fact that we've got a Lord of the Rings TV show on the way. What's it all about? Are we going to get, finally, the backstory of, you know, the Middle Age, the Second Age of that amazing fantasy series? Well, it sounds like we are going to, and I'm very excited to see where that's going to go. It may not exactly be something that's been covered before in any of the live-action material, but, you know, who knows who should be cast in these films.
Coming soon to Amazon Prime is the brand new series coming to you from the people that brought you The Lord of the Rings and, of course, the monumental saga, The Hobbit. That's right, three films made about one book. And now we bring you The Lord of the Rings, the TV show. Starring the one, the only, Sylvester Stallone as Sauron.
Hey, ya, Frodo!
You know, it's been a long time since Arnold Schwarzenegger has given us a half-decent film. The last big-budget, massive film he did was Terminator Genisys, and let's face it, it didn't quite cut the mustard. That's right. Now, I think the only saving grace for the big Arnie man himself is, of course, the new Conan script that's been going around for quite some time called Legend of Conan. After watching Conan the Barbarian the other night and, of course, looking at Conan the Destroyer, which is far more comic booky and far more fantastical than the first Barbarian movie itself, I think it's time we got the Unforgiven of all films when it comes to the barbarian trade. And I think Arnold will really come back to the fore there if that is given the chance. We're talking about a character that's got a little bit more depth than anything he's done before. And as Arnold says, I'll be back. All right, before we get into the episode tonight, here's where you can catch this show and many others like it on Fandom Podcast Network. At fpnet.podbean.com, which is our main master feed. You also catch the actual show itself on the Podbean app. It's one of the greatest ways to check out the show. Also, if you like all the shows, you can catch them at all these different places where you can catch podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and of course, Google Play if you're an Android user. Now, also on social media channels, you can find us on Twitter at FanPodNetwork and on Facebook, you can catch us at Fandom Podcast Network's page there at facebook.com/Fandom Podcast Network. If you want to catch us on the email lines, email any ideas you have that the show might be able to cover, any other films you think that have been fantastic, you can catch us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com.
You can catch me, the host, Adam O'Brien, at obpopculture on Twitter and, of course, on Instagram as well, same handle. And don't forget to catch me on my other show, The Fantha from Down Under, a fortnightly look at Star Wars from Down Under on Fantha Tracks Radio or FanthaTracks.com. And also check out the great shows that I'm doing here on Phantom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre, where we look at Mad Max with Maximum Couch Potato, and also our brand new show, The Spicing Guild, looking at the adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune. Now, let's get into the show. Welcome to Lethal Mullet Podcast here on the one, the only Phantom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam O'Brien, the mullet himself, and joining me all the way over from the UK, that's right, all the way over a big, large pond we call the Waterway, is the one, the only leader and founder of the amazing The Bearded Trio. Now, to give you a quick background on The Bearded Trio, it is a website and entertainment source for all things John Williams, George Lucas, and of course, Steven Spielberg. And its owner is here with us today. That is the one, the only, Rob Wingfer. Buddy, how are you?
I'm okay. Well, that was a welcome. I should do this more often. Thanks for having me on the show.
And it is an absolute jam to have you here to have, chat about, of course, what you loved. Oh, absolutely jammed with excitement.
Is this Aussie talk going on already?
This is Aussie, mate. We can turn it up to 11 if you like with the Aussie. Hey, mate, you going? Yeah, we're talking about movies. Hey, how you going, mate? Yeah. But we won't do that.
Let's not do that.
So, Rob, obviously you and I have a long friendship from years in fandom, and of course we used to podcast together many years ago, but we're going to chat about tonight what you grew up with in the 1980s in terms of pop culture, but also action film cinema. What was happening in Wales at the time that was such an amazing thing for you to grow up with?
Well, if we go right back to the beginning of the decade, for me, the most exciting film, if you're going to say action film, it's got to be Raiders of the Lost Ark, isn't it? I mean let's put sci-fi to one side for a second, but I remember being in the cinema for something and seeing this trailer for this film, and it was like, what is this? It's Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's that guy. It's that Spielberg guy. Oh, look, it is the guy that did Star Wars. And the guy did the music. genuinely like that at the time. So for me, Raiders of the Lost Ark was so exciting because you're still on a high from Star Wars, and you see these guys that are associated with it. And they're making this film, and my parents were they're religious parents at the time, so my dad was kind of he liked a film that had maybe some kind of down to earth reality. Now I'm not saying Raiders of the Lost Ark is realistic, but he liked the idea that they were going after some religious artifact, the Ark of the Covenant. He said, that could be quite believable. So I quite liked it because at the time, I was, how old was I? I think I was about 7 or 8, something like that. So to see my dad excited about a film as well, really got me on board. So yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark ticked all the boxes for me. So that's what started my decade off for pop culture, popular movies, especially action films as well. I could go through each year if you want. We 82, we had E.T. that was the one that left a mark for me.
So one of the things I think that you've nailed there is that Spielberg had and George Lucas brought together not just a film for people like ourselves that like action and adventure, but it's a real family film. Like, everyone got into it, the fact that it carries you along.
Yeah, definitely. I remember being, it was quite an important thing for me back then as a child to watch a film and to see my parents enjoying it as well. Because It was like, yeah, you're enjoying something I enjoy. It's none of that... you're enjoying it, it can't be that cool. I really enjoyed it. You know, the fact that my parents, my family enjoyed, we were watching this film together and we all enjoyed it. You know, it was, mm-hmm. I remember my dad saying, you know, oh, the face melting bit was a bit far fetched at the end, but, you know.
But I think there was something cheesy about those effects. I mean, even to now, like we look back on it now, there was still.
Yeah.
Great in-camera effects, but what I liked about those was the fact that now they look cartoony, but that's what it was. It's a comic book come to life in some ways, the way that those serials were made.
Yeah, the classic Saturday morning cheesy action serial shows that they would show in the cinemas, you know, and before that they had the Flash Gordon, which again is another thing that inspired George Lucas, wasn't it, for Star Wars. There's nothing wrong with having that cheesy feel to something if it's done right. I think that's why when you look at something like Doctor Who, you know, you look back at Doctor Who from, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s with Tom Baker.
Tom Baker. He's kind of like the UK Arnold Schwarzenegger, is he? I am Doctor. Come on, do it.
I knew he'd start doing impressions, and it's all my fault.
I'll only do them if they get dragged into it. I'll only do it that way, won't we?
Oh dear, what was I saying? Yeah, the cheesiness, you know.
Yes.
You know, you're going about special effects, and then Doctor Who has that charm, which people look back and say, "Well, I used to," you know, they love that. And yeah, you got to remember as well, man, they didn't have CGI back then, so people, you know, the clever boffins at ILM, and then when you look at Doctor Who with the BBC, they didn't have any budget, so they used it was inspired by previous films and finding ways to be able to bring something to life, to make a face melt on the screen.
Mm.
You know, they were just very, very clever. I'm not saying that CGI is bad. I'm not one of those that thinks that, oh, we should never use CGI. We should all be practical effects. But it's just nice to look back and see how clever these people were to bring something to life on the screen, like a melting face. That's kind of why I like the 80s, you know, especially the films and TV shows. You can actually see the mechanics working, can't you, really?
Well, you can. You look at some of the effects of, like, John Carpenter's The Thing, and how, you know, it's like some of those effects where the creature work, the fake effect of things like the arms going out when they're forming into the new character.
That was Rick Baker, wasn't it?
Paul Verhoeven. He worked with what was the guy's name? He worked on Robocop. He worked on, I do believe, Rob Bottin. That's it. It was Rob Bottin.
Yeah, of course it was.
Did you hear about him?
These guys are so clever. We mentioned names like Rob Bottin and Rick Baker and Tom Savini and Stan Winston. How clever were these guys? Yeah. You know, they could bring stuff to life by using, you know, pig guts and, making that fit into there and then let's explode it, make it explode. so clever.
And the fact that, you know, they knew celluloid itself is a chemical process.
Yeah.
Things like blood or even just the look of, you know, the gore had to be not the red that you see in real life because it wouldn't look right on camera. You know, it's like a different, you know, it's like anything that they use. I mean, digital's now different. I mean, digital is so clear that when it picks up something, it would probably be as we see it. But it's amazing that, you know, the chemical process was something they had to think about when they were creating that stuff. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Is that what, do they have to change the color of the blood to make it look?
Well, to make it look more thick. So that's a horror movie thing. Actually, Kevin, who runs Phantom Podcast, his partner Erin, who's actually Australian, her mother and father are famous Australian actors out here, and her father was actually the guy that shot all the kangaroos in Crocodile Dundee.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But anyway, she's a huge horror fanatic, and they were talking about this sort of stuff, the fact that, you know, just the colour that they have to put into the blood on screen and stuff like that to make it actually make it look like it's real, you know? And
Is that why that when you look back at the old westerns and you see someone getting shot and you see their blood, it looks kind of pinkish instead of red? And I wonder if that's the same, because obviously they probably weren't compensating for the film at the time.
And not using the right dyes and stuff like that, they've got to use in the packs and stuff like that. It's interesting. And again, they've evolved those things over the years. And I think one thing that got me about Raiders of the Lost Ark too was that it felt old-fashioned at the time when we had films like Star Wars, obviously Empire Strikes Back had just come out, and even Blade Runner, I suppose, because these are all Harry's films. And they felt more futuristic. But then this definitely felt like an old-fashioned roller coaster.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why. I think it was needed, because, you know, it was that the Star Wars hit the screen and became a huge hit, and then I think you had, like we do with Marvel and superheroes, you know, everybody wants to get on the bandwagon, and it seems to dominate the cinema at the moment. And back then, you know, sci-fi was very much the in thing, and was dominating cinema, so this was a nice change of scene and pace, and I think it brought a lot of families together to go and watch it.
Oh, without a doubt. I think the one thing that I catch from that film, especially back in the 80s, where I was only probably about 4 or 5 when that came out, and one of the things I caught from it was what Harry says at the end of the movie. Hey, I'm just making this up as I go along. And I think that's part of what Spielberg...
I'm making this up as I go.
Yeah. See, impressions, you started. but what's great about it is that it feels that way in the way the story progresses, and the fact that it gets him out of one scrap into another scrap. And that I think, became sort of formulaic for a lot of films. You look at even the current sort of comic book films, they're really Indiana Jones movies.
Yeah, they're just classic action films. You know, you need 2 hours of. I know I mentioned the realism earlier on, you know, but you still got to have that element of disbelief and fantasy. You know, you beat up a Nazi guy and steal his outfit, and it fits perfectly. You know, that's the James Bond effect, isn't it?
It is.
You know, yeah. The other thing I loved about I remember as a kid watching that, I was blown away by the sound effects, which seemed to be just that Lucasfilm thing, doesn't it? You know, that you had your films at the time, but Lucasfilm always just knocked it out of the park with their sound effects, even down to just to, you know, firing a gun, starting up a plane engine. You know, it was just unique to Lucasfilm, and of course they had their library, and I know that they wanted to make sure that the sounds were unique, that they were different, and they definitely made it with the Raiders films. Really,
they did.
Raiders lost
that. You know, I think that a lot of people credit, obviously, Ben Burtt with, and rightly so, of course. But I go back to years and years ago, going to a drive-in theatre, and we watched this movie that, you know, at 4 years old, I still don't remember to this day, I thought. And then a couple of years later on VHS in the late 90s, we found THX-1138. And put it in the VCR, I went, wow, I've seen this movie before. Where did I see it? And we'd seen it at a drive-in theatre, which I don't think was done even back then. You know, it was a very rare thing for us, even out here in Australia. But what caught me was the sound. The sound even then of the radio chatter and stuff like that on that film. And that was Walter Mersch.
Yeah, I mean it's a good percentage of the enjoyment of a film, isn't it? It's all these elements that kind of come together. You can't just have good visuals on screen, and you can't even just have, you know, I'll probably get shot down in flames for this, but you can't just have a good story as well. You've got to have all the elements to come together. You know, you've got to have good sound, a good, you know, good. It's got to look good on screen. It's got to have a good story. It's got to have a good soundtrack. You know, it's got to have a good director, good actors, actresses. Put them all together, and you get that golden nugget, which doesn't happen very often. And that's why we talk about these films decades later, because They're rare. They don't happen all the time.
No, that's
right. You can get a film that maybe have two or three of the elements, and you think, that was a great film. And you could talk about it a year or so later and say, yeah, that was good, that was okay. But you very rare these days get a film that's got all the elements together. And you think, you know, is there a film that you've watched in the last 5 years? You can be honest, that you're going to be talking about in decades to come.
Oh yeah, Blade Runner 2049, definitely.
I knew he was going to say Blade Runner.
But
I knew it.
You have a point. No, you have a really good point. There's certain stories even that lend themselves to a really good, whether it's design, action, and even just drawing in science fiction people. You look at one of the biggest turkeys ever made was Battlefield Earth. Biggest turkeys ever. Yeah.
I went to cinema to see that.
Did you? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm still trying to recover.
But it's a shame because, I'm not somebody that follows L. Ron Hubbard's work, but the book itself is actually a decent book. The book's quite a good read. It's a shame because that's a little bit like Dune and other big science fiction, even like Starship Troopers. The core of the book is actually strong. To take that and turn it into a John Travolta crazed sort of alien invasion movie was really, you know, misinformed. But all your elements there are sort of a Mad Maxian sort of wasted future sort of look to it. Aliens, an interesting sort of culture coming in. And also oppression and, of course, a hero that's got to overcome that. So all your elements are there, but unfortunately, that was the biggest, worst film of the 2000s, without a doubt.
Yeah, that's it. Because it had a different meaning as well, didn't it?
Yes.
But the elements, they just didn't gel. And there's probably other films that have that missed the mark as well.
Wing Commander.
Oh, gosh, yeah, Wing Commander.
It's a shame, too.
I'm so disappointed. That was one of the films I was so disappointed over. Yep. Because I was a huge Wing Commander fan. I love my video games. Yes. I love my PC games. And I played Wing Commander. I thought when I first played Wing Commander 3,
mm-hmm.
You've started me off on video games now, look. So, sorry. I remember Wing Commander 3, with Mark Hamill and John Rhys Davis and... It was such an experience to play and to watch. And then Wing Commander 4. And when the film, they brought this film out. What a disappointment that film was.
It really was. I mean, they completely missed the fact that you've already got a built-in audience with those characters. And, you know, at the ages. And then they had the idea of bringing in Freddie Prinze Jr., who... I have to say he's a big gamer himself, so, you know, big ode to him there. But not his fault that they decided to go really, really small scale and obviously younger characters' ages. Yeah, anyway, but I mean, it didn't hit the mark, did it?
No, it didn't. No, it was such a big disappointment, really. But there we go, you know. But you never know, we might either get another Wing Commander film by the time the Star Citizen comes out.
Well, yes. I've seen a little bit on YouTube about what they're putting together there too. Now, is Mark Hamill also involved in this one? From what I see, he is.
Well, if there's they've done like a small episode kind of thing, like a segment game, like a single player. Well, it's not single player, but it's like a chapter of the game, and they got Mark Hamill and Gillian Anderson. And so forth in it, but the actual game itself, which is this massive open universe experience, is just it's still does seem to be miles away, unfortunately, millions of dollars away. And so many people have invested in it. So yeah.
What do they call it? A Kickstarter one, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and they made. Wasn't it one of the game held a record for raising the most money? I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions.
That's right.
And we haven't really got a great deal to show for it. Unfortunately, I'm still waiting for that one amazing space open universe game that will just blow me away. We've been close. but yeah. We're still waiting for it. Elite Dangerous was close, but you know it lacks depth.
We need a Stargate one.
Yeah, and we almost had it as well, didn't we? We almost did. Had that RPG, Stargate. I remember, that they showed screenshots of that game, and I remember if you watch, I think it was the first episode of Stargate Universe. I can't remember the character, but the guy who's being tested, and you have O'Neill knock on the door. That was the Stargate online game that he was playing.
Wow.
Yeah, but unfortunately got shelved. Yeah. Can you imagine playing a Stargate MMORPG? I mean, let's be honest, Stargate, they've never really, in regards to franchise stuff that's out there, they've never really done, you know, much with it. Let's see what we can do with it, you know? Star Wars, you know, we have, and Star Trek to a certain extent, but Stargate, they just don't seem to capitalize on it, really.
No, they don't.
Do a lot with it.
But the news is that Brad Wright is actually being contacted by the creators and owners of currently of the copyright itself, and they're talking about doing something. Now, they did do something last 2 years, which was called Stargate Origins. And I haven't watched any of it, to be honest, but it's not set within the SG-1 universe, but in the movie universe, and sets up what happens to the Doctor at the start of Stargate.
Which Doctor? Well, Dr. Jackson?
Not Dr. Jackson, but
the woman.
The elderly lady, yeah.
Okay, the old lady, I remember, yeah.
So, you know, it's so more like...
Is this set in, like, the 40s or something then, is it?
Yeah, I think it might even be earlier. I think it might be, like, late 20s, early 30s, something like that.
When they discovered the Stargate in Egypt.
Yeah. And it's there's Nazis in it, you know. It's more a Raiders of the Lost Ark feel, if anything. You know, it
sounds like a young Indiana Jones story,
doesn't it? Yeah.
Which I would watch. I would love that. That's a series they could bring back, and I would be all for that.
Now, did they ever release that on Blu-ray? I can't remember if they did.
I don't think they did. If they did, then I don't think they did a proper conversion of it. I think
would have been pretty just basic TV crossover or whatever they call it. I mean, the DVDs when they were released out here, we devoured. I mean, we got the box set pretty much the week that it came out, and I can remember
amazing artwork. They had amazing artwork. Remember the artwork on the front?
Yeah,
they were really good. I love that series. A great series. So Catherine Zeta-Jones in one episode, isn't she?
She is. She's in the Aussie episode, and the reason we say that is that it's in Beersheba, where the Light Horse were. That's right. You got the Anzacs, which are the Australians going down there. That's right. We're gonna go and take on the Turks. That's right. And of course, the Light Horse were the ones that stopped the attack at Beersheba. And there's actually a film out there. If you go and check it out, it's called The Light Horseman, and it's all about that attack. A lot of the footage in those episodes is actually taken from that film, because the director of that was the director on the young Indiana Jones.
That's good trivia. I like that.
That's right. And Cameron Daddo's in it, who's one of our, 1980s television presenters that was given a chance at film, so long as he looked tough on film with a Anzac hat on the side going, "Righto, we get over there. You get on your horse, mate. Here we go." And of course, he had a chance, but it was Peter Phelps and a number of other amazing Australian actors did the actual film, The Light Horseman. If you haven't seen it, it's a must. But you got some really terrible Australian acting in there as the German and Turkish army in there. They should have just, to be honest, they should have got real people from the region to do it. It would have been far better than, "G'day, mate, I'm a German."
I'm going to have to watch it
now. it is very well shot. Amazing horse action within the film itself. And shot down in South Australia where they shot Gallipoli.
Okay.
So that sounds awful. So I'm going to watch it. Yeah, you got to check it out.
One of my favourite Aussie films is The Dish.
Oh, brilliant. Yep, shot in Cowra in New South Wales.
I love a film. Great film. If you haven't, you know, anybody listening to this who hasn't checked out The Dish, then go and watch it, because it's based on a true story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, Sam Neill's in it, and it's a really good story. It's also funny as well.
It is. It's a comedy at heart. But it's obviously about the time when, in 1969, when the landing on the moon, and it was our chance as the planet moved around and we were in line with the moon, we got all the communications for NASA.
Yeah, and you lost the signal.
Yeah, we lost the signal, all right.
No spoilers.
But what are some of the other films in the 1980s that attracted you? Of course, some of the numerous Jaws films, which you're a big fan of, obviously the first film. We won't mention a certain fourth, because I know you won't want to talk about that one, but let's talk about at least the second film and the third one.
Let's start with the third one. I absolutely detest that film.
It's shark bait.
I went to the cinema to see that in 3D.
Oh, wow.
And even then, what year did Jaws 3 come out?
Oh, 1984, was it?
I think it was around then. Yeah. So I'm not going to say I was 12 years old. So as a 12-year-old, you know, you're just starting to not believe all the hype. But I was hyped up for Jaws 3D, and I remember going to see it and putting those red and blue 3D glasses on and absolutely being so disappointed, not just with the film, but with the special effects. You know, when you have a floating fish head floating on the screen for about 30 seconds, because the pacing, if you watch that film now on TV, the pacing, I mean, it was bad back then, but now the pacing of the film is so bad, because, you know, you've got these 3D objects, they're trying to do the, let's make this image
step out from the TV.
So it's just stuck there on the screen like the floating head of a fish. I hate that film. I really hate it. And my friend's got that on. I don't know whether he's got it on Blu-ray. But have you ever seen that film on Blu-ray?
Yes, I have. I've got it on Blu-ray.
It's one of the worst conversions of a film I've ever seen. It's like, what, do you remember the old QuickTime videos you used to watch on your PC in the 90s? And then you blow it up to full screen and you're like, oh, God, that looks terrible. That's what it looks like on Blu-rays.
Heavily pixelated.
Yeah, it didn't even deserve a proper conversion. Someone went, slap it on Blu-ray, sell it, I never want to see it again. So that's my thoughts on Jaws 3.
Now, Jaws 2, which for us out here, we had some terrible movie trailers for the second one. I actually didn't mind the second film too much, but, you know, it was the whole B-movie feel. You know, it was Roy Scheider's back, and this time he's taking out the trash. You know, it was literally built around the revenge of, you know, that's it, it's revenge for the sharks, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But we got to see that one on the big screen. That was fun.
Yeah. And I think the problem with Jaws 2 is it has to follow Jaws. It's got that problem, you know, Jaws 2. I like Jaws 2. Mm-hmm. I think it was a great film. I genuinely thought it was a great film. Now I watch it and, you know, the screaming teenagers kind of get to me. So I'm just getting old, you know. that's just me. But the problem with Jaws 2, I compare Jaws 2 with, who was the actor follow Queen at Live Aid in 1984?
Oh God!
Exactly. That's Jaws 2.
It is.
I'm not saying, you know, the actor follow Queen was perfectly good at what they did, everybody enjoyed it, but that's Jaws 2. It had to follow a perfect film. I remember seeing it and I enjoyed it. I thought it was good, and of course we still had the music of John Williams.
Yes, we
as
did.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, I remember the one piece of music in the film, the catamaran race. It's even now, it's one of my favorite. It's one of my all-time favorite pieces of John Williams music, because it reminds me of summer. It's got that that, you know, when you see the catamarans going out to sea and they're all having fun and throwing water bombs at each other and racing each other, and you're accompanied by the John Williams piece of music, it makes me happy. It reminds me of summer.
It's a joyful sort of, it's positive sort of music feel to it. And it's uplifting, you know, and I think that's what John Williams does, is he really taps into emotion more than anyone else. Yeah. You compare them to Hans Zimmer in The Dark Knight. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Yeah, I really feel the
bass drum. Hans Zimmer can do some nice music as well.
He can, he can. I think that's more Nolan pressuring him.
You know, he can do some nice music.
You know what that is? It is Chris Nolan literally in there going, maybe a little bit more bass drum, mate. Can you put a bit more bass drum in it? Dun 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 dun. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. But going back to Jaws 2, the other reason why I like that movie is because I've been a geek, or as we call back then, a nerd. You get called a nerd if you like Star Wars and Star Trek, and you got made fun of in school. You know, being a nerd or a geek back then isn't as cool as it is now. You know, if you get called a geek these days, you know, it's kind of cool. But back then, you got made fun of in school and so forth. And yeah, I didn't, you know, I'm going to admit, no, I got made fun of in school because I was a nerd. I remember watching Jaws 2, and there were some, you know, the classic nerd-looking kids in there wearing the glasses. But they came good, you know, at the end. And I kind of liked that. You know, it was nice to see a movie where you know, they were helping just as much as the other teenagers were. I can't remember if one of them, I know one of them ended up, didn't end up with a girl, but I'd like to think he did.
What about some of the films that were sort of influenced by those, or even the music? You look at Craig Safran and The Last Starfighter, the music in that is so influenced by Williams. So good.
Oh, I love that. You know, it's kind of music that you listen to on a Monday morning on your way to work. You know, if you're feeling a bit, I'm feeling a bit groggy, you put on that music from The Last Starfighter, turn it up, and in your car, and within a couple of minutes, you are buzzing. It is so good. Yeah.
But even that, you know, that sort of, I suppose, more modern take of the hero's journey too. I mean, it's... It's classic Spielberg.
It is. Do you know what? I think I remember watching The Last Starfighter and thinking it was actually a Spielberg film. When it came out.
Yeah, I can see that.
I thought it was a Spielberg film, yeah. Just as much as I thought E.T. was a Disney film when it came out.
You know what? That actually makes a lot of sense.
Well, there's a story behind it. The reason why I thought that is... oh dear! Can I confess this? Back in the early '80s, if you had a video recorder, you used to get a lot of pirate copies of films. You know, there would always be someone around the corner. Uh-huh. That would go, I can get that for you. You know, this is the latest film from America, because back then, you know, we didn't. The films would get released about 6 months later than they were in America.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to watch Watchers in the Woods. I was a huge Disney fan. And I remember, again, because going back to my parents being religious, if we watch a Disney film, there's not going to be any swearing in it. So we could watch it together. And I said to my dad, can you get Watchers in the Woods? He's not out yet. He said, yeah, well, I'll see what I can do. And he came back, so I couldn't get it. But I've got this other Disney film called E.T., I knew nothing about it. We watched it, loved it, but there was, I think at one point, Michael swears and says SH1T. I was devastated because I'm watching this Disney film with my parents. It wasn't a Disney film, obviously. Watching E.T. with my parents, and there's a swear word in it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're not gonna enjoy Disney films anymore because they're swearing. I was so devastated. So that's why, one of my memories of E.T. I want to say that I have made up for the fact that I watched a pirate copy of E.T. because I probably bought it for about five times and got to the cinema to see it as well. So I think I made up for the fact that we had a dodgy copy of E.T. But I think everybody back then had a dodgy copy of E.T. It seemed to be the film that everybody watched on their video before it came out in the cinema.
But, oh, look, everyone had two-head VCR where they were doing that. Everyone had one. Two-head VCR. Where we'd have, you put one video in and another one video would go on the other side and you go, cut for a copy.
Yeah, we had the piano key videos. Remember that?
The ones
where you're at, you know, the top loader, the thing comes out at the top and you had to press record and play at the same time to record something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time, I'm sorry, this might be the 70s. Not, I know you want to talk about 80s. But the very first time we had a video player, right, video recorder, my mum said, we started recording something off the TV, and my mum said, are we allowed to talk, or will it come out on tape?
You know, the first VHS I saw was actually, I didn't know what I was watching. I thought I was watching Days of Our Lives or something like that. And then this British voice came up and said, oh, mate, I'm a doctor. And yeah, it's a telephone booth, and we're going in back in time. So I went, who is that? And ended up being, I think it was, crikey, I can't even remember which doctor it was at the time, but it was my introduction into VCRs, because we taped the wrong channel. And it was channel ABC out here, which is the BBC, basically, for Australia. And So we got a lot of we got EastEnders, which we had no idea what the hell was about until we watched it. Dear. And then we went, it's just like a bad version of Neighbours.
Yeah. I'd watch Neighbours any time of the week over EastEnders. And that's saying something. But then I did used to fancy Jane Mangle. sorry about that.
Oh, my goodness. Have we got Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue and Guy Pearce on the telly?
Yeah. I used to run home to watch Neighbours. I wanted when Bouncer was ill, I needed to know what was going to happen to Bouncer.
I remember when they used the stunt dog on that one too, where they had, oh no, Bouncer's been hit.
How did you possibly know that?
And of course the dogs just walked across there. There's a dog on the side there.
Right, that's enough Neighbours talk now. One last thing about Neighbours, right? I'm going to confess now. I bought the 7-inch single of the theme tune. I actually paid money for that.
You see, folks, for you folks listening tonight on Little Mullet Podcast, one of the things in Australia we do is we export a lot of things. We export Fosters because we don't drink it, but we make it. We export Home and Away, Neighbours, and Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan, but we don't get ourselves entertained by them.
Cell Block H. Yeah. what was that other one? Yeah, a lot of your Neighbours soap stars became huge rock pop stars, you know?
They did too.
Thanks for that.
It's crazy, isn't it? Now, one of the other ones I used to like in the 1980s that I think took off was John Carpenter. I think along with Spielberg and especially Lucas and even, I suppose, to a certain degree, a lot of the mainstream directors, Carpenter was an odd choice for films a lot of the time because he'd worked with low budgets and, he kept everything in-house. You know, he did the music himself. But I think a lot of those films are quintessential.
Yeah, they were. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. The reason why John Carpenter was so popular, especially with the film studios, is the low budget.
Yeah.
But they make huge amounts of money because he came, you know, in the horror community, he became very, very popular. He had that kind of cult following, like Spielberg and George Lucas in the horror community. John Carpenter was, he could do no wrong. I remember I used to buy the Fangoria magazine, which was all about horror films, and every magazine would have some John Carpenter stuff in there. And let's be honest, that I had Halloween 2 on the other day actually, and that opening scene you know, with Donald Pleasance, and he says, "I shot him six times, he's not human." I remember watching that and just being blown away, especially with that music as well. That simple, plunky...
It is, yeah.
...music, but it just hits home. It's so good, and yeah, and the thing as well,
wasn't it incredible? It's memorable. They are memorable. I think that's the big thing about a lot of those ones. Plus, a lot of those actors, obviously Jamie Lee Curtis was involved in those films. But there's also, even in The Fog and in Escape from New York, there's that actor that went on to, I think he played Huntsacker in Lethal Weapon. And he was the guy who goes to Danny Glover, he goes, "Come on, Raj, you go get these boys. You go get them. You get them." Yeah. So he's the one whose daughter dies of drugs and overdose or something like that at the start. And but all these little actors that you see in films.
I remember now you say that. I do remember that. Yeah. Oh, I remember that guy.
Yeah. "You go get them, Roger. You get these men."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, he played Lee Van Cleef's offsider in Escape from New York at the start. When they, you know, Snake comes in and goes, "Call me Snake. Call me Snake." All right, yeah, right, old Plushkin, sit down. Shut up.
Yeah. That's a film that I think I've only watched once.
Yeah.
I know. I need to watch it again. I do need to see that again.
I kind of distilled down what Kurt Russell was doing in those movies and with Jack Burton in Big Trouble in Little China, and it's quite simple. You know, in Snake Plissken, he's basically being Clint Eastwood. But in Jack Burton, he is being John Wayne. He's even talking like John Wayne, you know. If John Wayne wants to drive the Pork Chop Express, he's going to drive the Pork Chop Express, you know. And I think there was, even in those films, a touch of the serial, a touch of that comic book element, an action element that we saw in, of course, Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah, you do see it. Yeah, and it's that kind of cheesiness, or going back to basics, is kind of coming back again, isn't it? You're seeing it come back again, which is nice. Yeah. It's nice sometimes not to be too serious. There's too much of that in the real world. So to have that escapism for 2.5 hours, it's kind of nice. And you know, we just don't take movies too serious. Just enjoy them.
100%. I think people should do that with fandom as well. You know, just enjoy what you have. It's a blessing that we have this stuff around us.
Exactly. I mean, you have a podcast, I run a website, we have reviews, you know, we don't need to pull these things apart too much, you know. At the end of the day, they're a window of fantasy for 2 hours or so, and let's just enjoy them.
100%.
You know, you got to look back, especially if you're, you know, an adult who grew up in the 70s and 80s, we were spoiled by some really good films, going back to right at the beginning of the episode when I said, all those elements, when they come together, you get a film that you talk about decades later. You're not always going to get that. And I think the problem is that we look back at our youth over the decades, when we have our film-watching history, and we look back with rose-tinted glasses sometimes and think that it was so much better back then. And it's not. It's just that it takes a while for an amazing film to come out. And the problem is, we look back and think, that was an amazing film, that was an amazing film, that was an amazing film. But if you look back at all the amazing films, they're years apart.
Yes.
You know, we're still making good films, but, you know, it's just, we can't get angry because something isn't amazing every time.
That's right. You can't have, for every Wonder Woman you get, you know, a Suicide Squad. For every, you know, it's one of those things. There's always going to be something to offside it. And I think, you know, going back to that era, you realise that people learn from what's come before.
Yeah, and yes, you do. And you can kind of see DC films trying to do that, trying to learn from their previous mistakes. And they are getting there, you know. And I still enjoyed, you know, just... I enjoyed Justice League.
Same here.
I, I enjoyed it, you know? Mm-hmm. It didn't take itself too seriously, and it was just a good superhero film for a couple of hours.
Oh, yeah.
And it, you know, let's hope they carry on doing films that entertain.
That's right, and they got one thing right. They didn't let Batman go around, I'm going to kill everyone because I'm Batman. You know? And then Superman, I'm going to kill everyone because I like collateral damage.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, there are so many good movies in the 80s, in every decade, really.
That's right.
You know, but I will say, though, that the 80s seem to have the most, don't they? They seem to have, you seem to be, you know, like, I know I said every couple of years you'd have a great film come out. You look at the 80s, and it may not have been every year, but it was close. It was pretty close. Yeah. So there was a film that, you know, you can talk about for an hour.
We could. I mean, there's a great film in 1980 that kicked it all off. And, of course, it's one of our favourite films. Now, 1980, obviously, was on the verge of all these different great films. Obviously, we had Indiana Jones kicking off less than, what was it, probably a year after, in 81 or whatever, when it came out. And we got those three great films. But going back to 1980, we had a film set in a prisoner of war camp. And this was a very, very serious film. It involved a soccer ball. It involved Stallone.
I was just crashing out, going down here, and you know, I was, were you playing soccer?
Hello, mate, I'm Michael Caine. Would you like to join our soccer team? We're going to take on the Nazis.
The Escape to Victory.
That's right.
It's very, very popular film over here in the UK, because I don't know whether if other countries are aware about the, I'm going to say friendly, there's a rivalry, friendly rivalry between the England football team and Germany football team. You know, it's like England and Australia in the Ashes. When the two come together, it's like, yeah, we're going to beat you, and, you know.
And that funny always, thing you guys call football.
Yeah. And it's always that thing with England and Germany in the football. And for years, you know, they'd always beat us on penalties until quite recently. And then, but the Escape to Victory, I think, was very popular over here because England, well, let's say England, the Allies, we'd say, beat, you know, Germany. Is that a spoiler? That was a spoiler. Sorry about that.
That is a spoiler.
They didn't actually beat... No, they didn't beat them, did they?
No, they didn't, no.
No, they didn't. That's even more of a spoiler. Sorry. They just scored a couple of goals, didn't they?
They did.
It was like the Deep Space Nine episode when when they kicked baseball against the Vulcans, and the Vulcans thrashed them because the Niners managed to get one run against them. They classed it as a win.
They did, but, yeah, too. That's right.
Deep Space Nine episode is based on Escape to Victory.
It's funny how it comes back around like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's nuts. Now, listeners, you've got to go and check out, obviously, the beardedtrio.com, which is just a wealth of information, blogs. And I tell you what, if there's anything you want to know about John Williams, Steven Spielberg, or, of course, George Lucas, it's going to be there. Tell the folks about your website.
I think you just said it, really. Yeah, the Bearded Trio. It's just a bit of fun, really. I just wanted to start it because I love those guys. You know, they seem to be with me through most of my life, and I just wanted some way of paying back and saying thank you. So it's just a website dedicated to the three, and we have some great guest bloggers on there. We've just had a recent one talking about the 30 years of Always, which is always classed as an underrated Spielberg film. Frank Marshall tweeted about it yesterday, so go and check it out.
And of course, Geek Universal.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.